57. Moot. Bill, October 2204, Epsilon Eridani. I held the air horn over my head and pressed the button twice, and received the usual round of boos, gotta love tradition. The catcalls were short-lived, though, more of a formality. The word had gotten out, and the Bobs were all business today. Even the pre-meeting session had been quiet, with a growling undertone. First, before we get to the main event, I'd like to introduce our newest long-range champion. I gestured to a nearby Bob. Bruce is from Calvin and Goku's first cohort. He's calling in from 11 Leonis Minoris and holds the record at 37 light-years from Earth. Sorry, Mario. The crowd applauded Bruce, and several people came over to talk to him. When the chatter had died down, I held the air horn up for a moment and waited for quiet. I guess you've all heard by now, but I'll summarize just to make sure we haven't missed anything. We have communicated with the others. They appear to have captured the Chinese probe at some point and stripped its data. The good news is that they speak Mandarin, so communications were pretty straightforward. The bad news is they know where Earth is. And thanks to my ham-handed broadcasts to every star system in sight, they know about Epsilon Eridani as well. I waved off the yelled comments. No, they won't get the Scut plans. The broadcasts were encrypted, as is everything we do. And the Chinese probe wouldn't know anything about the transmission or file formats, so they wouldn't be able to separate out encrypted data from transport envelope. I waited for any objections, then continued. The other piece of good news is that they are sufficiently arrogant that they don't feel the need to come over and squash us forthwith. Their attitude seems to be that they'll get to us when they get to us. This produced low growls from the audience, and I grinned. Now, we got some good scans of the Armada, and we're able to observe their operations as they strip GL-54. I'm going to call up Garfield to give us a rundown in a minute, but first, I want to thank Hal for successfully testing the new Heaven design against the Death asteroids. At least in that area, we are ahead of the game. There were cheers from the audience and the usual first verse of Bicycle Built for Two. It never got old. Hal grinned to the crowd, waved, and took a bow. Garfield walked up onto the podium and glared at me. I laughed, held up the horn, and gave it a blast. "Okay," Garfield yelled over the boos. "I have a bit of egg on my face. My guesstimates of the power capabilities and weaponry of the Death asteroid were a little off because the others are actually more inventive than I thought. I just hope they don't have more surprises." Garfield waited for silence, and he got it. Every Bob in the room was now completely focused on his words. "Power beaming via Sudar. It's not just for running those little ant things they use for harvesting. It's also for charging Death asteroids remotely. The Death asteroids are capable of charging themselves without help, but it looks like it would take about a day on their own. So, they have huge reactors in the cargo carriers, which in combination with the Sudar beaming can run ants, drones, mining carriers, or charge up Death asteroids." "Why?" yelled someone from the crowd. "Seems unnecessarily complicated." Garfield nodded in the general direction of the voice. "I think it's dictated by their biology. It's pretty obvious from Bill's conversation with them that they're a hive organism. A large portion of the interior of the Death asteroids is living space. Far too much, in my opinion, to be justifiable just based on personnel requirements. Every vehicle they have is either automated or has the same large living space. I think they need to live in large groups. They may get some version of agoraphobia or something if there aren't enough of their brethren around." "Well, it would explain their decision to build the Dyson Sphere," Hal said from the front of the audience. "That and their comment about going to war with any splinter group," I added. "That could be phenotypical behavior as well. These beings seem to be very much driven by their biology. It may be that their reference to all other life as food is more of the same. Something that drives their actions at such an instinctual level can be taken advantage of. If we can figure out how. That's one of the tasks I want you guys to take out of this meeting. There were silent nods throughout the room and a palpable aura of anticipation. I'd tried to keep this quiet, but somehow word had gotten out. "And now, the moment you've all been waiting for," I grinned at the crowd. "We got images of the others from the scans. The detail isn't great, of course. The drone was too—"
"Less talk, more show,"
I snapped my mouth shut. So much for building the drama. With a wave, I brought up the composite 3D image that we'd put together. There were oohs and ahs from the crowd. The other was hard to describe, simply because it was hard to get a perspective on it. The scale superimposed on the image indicated that it was about 4 feet tall, although it didn't really stand straight. Color shaded between an oily green-violet sheen through gray to black. I looked at the perplexed faces in the crowd. I understand that look. I'd worn it recently. But I'd been examining all the images since we separated them from the scans, so I had somewhat of a head start on figuring it out. Okay. Think of the posture of a gorilla. Not quite a quadruped, but not quite upright. These things that look kind of like meaty wings are the front, limbs. The back limbs are more like a split tail, except that there's also a tail. Visualize a sea lion's back end with a tail tacked on. The front limbs have these big appendages that look like fat fingers, but I don't think they're for manipulating. They have suckers on them, so I think they're more for gripping their prey. The creature has what I'd have to describe as feeding fingers that fold out from here, I pointed to the front of the thing, and appear to be dexterous enough to act as manipulators. They also direct food into the maw. I switched to another image, which showed the thing with its front split open in a vertical slash, which doesn't masticate so much as grind and strip the meal. I think it would be particularly slow and painful to be eaten by these things. I switched images again and pointed to the front. The head does appear to have the primary sensory apparatus, although what looks like the brain is more centrally located here. I pointed to a spot high on the main trunk. Vision is not great. It seems to be a large number of small eyes spaced around the dome of the head. You have to wonder why a predator would need 360-degree vision. I switched back to the first picture. The scan indicated they were packed into the living area with a density similar to us in this room, except that it was like that everywhere. No empty rooms, no private quarters. They are probably always packed in like sardines. I gestured dramatically. Ladies, gentlemen, I give you the others. There was dead silence for a few milliseconds. Then someone said, "Should we clap?" Everyone in the room broke up in laughter and the tension dissolved. If I ever found out who the speaker was, I'd have to buy him a beer. I left the image up and closed the meeting. People broke into groups to discuss the presentation. Mario raised his chin in my direction, and I acknowledged the implied invitation with a wave. Mario grimaced. I had a theory that the presence of the Death Asteroids was proof that they don't scout a system. Otherwise, they'd have known they didn't need them at GL-54. But if they're a communal organism, then the Death Asteroids are their portable community. Mario gave me a rueful smile. Yep. Fail. So how is the harvest going? He rolled his eyes and pulled up some images. Thankfully, there was nothing in GL-54 to get attached to, so this is nothing more than a strategic retreat to me. Pointing to one image. The carriers go down where presumably they've detected metal. They disgorge ants who dig down to the ore and bring it up. It's hard to tell from a distance, but based on activity, I think they use the ore to build more ants, which they use to get more ore, which they use to build more ants. Eventually, they reach a break-even point of some kind where the ants just haul material up. Then they harvest the excess ants and take off. They'd have printers specialized for making ants then. I stroked my chin and thought. It would have to be a cheap, quick process. At the current rate, I estimate they'll have the system cleaned out in a year. It's exponential behavior. They never stop, never rest. Mario rubbed his eyes. And those cargo ships are so big.
I don't think we could even make them notice us, let alone damage them significantly. It would be like mosquitoes trying to take on tanks. Well, we have to come up with something before they decide Earth is next. Mario shook his head. There are a lot of systems closer to them than Earth. We have lots of time. You're assuming that they always do things that way. You're assuming that they won't suddenly decide to drive a little extra distance for some ready-made refined material. I glared at him, willing him to get the point. I think we have to assume we don't have a lot of time. If we're ready early, no biggie. If we're ready late, biggie. Damn.